this show, there will be discussions of the true crime variety. Murder, mayhem, violence, and adult themes will be talked of. Listener discretion is advised. Hello, everybody. How's everyone doing? Me, I'm doing great. Thanks for asking. So this week, my sis and I geeked out on American Murder, The Family Next Door, that just came out on Netflix. It's the Chris Watts case, and it's an absolutely disturbing family annihilator story. But I wanted to cover a different family annihilator because I have been obsessed with this case, and that is the case of Susan Cox Powell and the murder-suicide of her children, Charles and Brayden, by her husband, Joshua Powell. This week, I'm going to do a deep dive on cold. It's a deep dive! Deep dive! Okay, so cold. That is the name of the podcast. It is a Wondery Productions in association with KSL Radio. It is hosted by a renowned investigative journalist, Dave Cawley. So this podcast came out on November 13th of 2018 and was last had an updated episode September 16th of 2020. So the story of Susan Cox Powell, I'm going to try and state in my own words based on the show episodes and what they cover, and hopefully I can kind of get the story out without being too confusing, because if I don't have it wrote down, I think I'll just go all over the place. But anyway, like I am right now. Susan disappeared on December 6, 2009, at the age of 28 from West Valley, Utah. So the first episode is called To All the Girls I've Loved Before, because this is all about Josh Powell's extremely tumultuous upbringing with his father, Steve, and mother, Terry. They had five kids, Steve and Terry did, and they were all married and raised with the LDS Church, which is the Church of Latter-day Saints. Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. So that's the Mormon religion. And what happened is Steve ends up completely losing his faith in the religion and going completely the opposite direction. So Steve and Terry have a awful divorce, just totally crazy awful, where Steve is telling the kids that their mother is evil and their mother is telling the kids that Steve is evil, and it just goes back and forth. I kind of feel bad for Terry. She really just seems like she just wants to be a good mom, and it is just getting sabotaged by Steve left and right. So, Josh, you hear a lot of his audio journals in this, and he really talks like he is on another planet with another just wispy and I just want to punch his stupid face. But anyway, so episode two is called Wake Up Little Susie. So after a quick two-month dating process led to proposal. She was living with him, much to her family's dismay. At this point, Josh insisted on a very quick wedding. He wasn't letting Sue leave, like Catherine, his last girlfriend, who had to escape his controlling behavior. They end up moving in with Josh's father, Steve, to save money. This ends up being just a horrible idea. Episode 3 is called Faith and Finances, and in this episode, Susan, a faithful LDS member, is being verbally abused when Josh falls from the faith. So now Josh is starting to pick up his father's attitude, and what really brought Josh and Susan together was their shared faith. So this is already going to start causing rifts. We find that Josh is completely useless as a worker. There was many people. He never could keep down a job, and on other projects like, you know, their deck, and he would have someone help. He was just awful. He was not at all helpful. He was distracting. He was just described as being completely useless. But he has thousands of dollars in tools. Meanwhile, Susan has always had a steady job, but she is not allowed to spend the money for anything on herself while Josh basically takes the car, and she's just meant to, she's left to ride her bike to work up a busy interstate, and it's nothing, and he's controlling all of her and their finances, but he has no, doesn't seem to have any limit on his spending. That's when they decide to just file for bankruptcy. Episode 4 is Find Susan. The boys aren't at daycare, and the daycare attendant becomes concerned. So she starts raising the flag as, where are the boys? But she has other kids to take care of. It is Josh's oldest sister, Jennifer Graves, and in quotes I say the good one, reports the family missing. That's when they finally hear from Josh. And so in episode 5, Josh comes in for an interview without the boys to distract him from answering questions. The interview is real vague, with Josh taking long pauses to answer any of the questions. His story is he took the boys camping with their only car on a Sunday when they both have to go to work in the morning in a snowstorm at 1:30 to 2 a.m. I think it's important to add that Josh, when he was being raised by Steve, had no rules set on him at all. He had no curfew. He had no responsibilities. It sounds to me like he was allowed to do whatever he wants, and he does not seem to have any concept of time at all. He doesn't seem to have any of these boundaries on what we would normally consider time. So for him, he's like, yeah, of course I took the boys in the middle of a snowstorm at 2 a.m., It doesn't seem to raise any red flags for him, but everyone else thinks this is extremely suspicious, and of course it is. Episode 6 is called Josh in the Wind. Josh disappears in a rental car after the police interview, and no one knows where he is for a number of hours. I think to this day they still don't know what he did in those hours. His creepy dad, Steve, is interviewed. As you'll know, you start to realize that the reason I called him Creepy Steve is because while Josh and Susan were living with Steve, Steve had created a fantastic obsession with Susan. He believed that Susan was kind of flirting with him and hitting on him, and he just harbored this lust over her. He was constantly filming her. He was even putting like mirrors under the bathrooms to like peek on her. These were all very creepy voyeuristic tendencies, and it's gonna bite him in the butt later. Episode 7 is called Scouring the Desert, and the search for Susan takes place in the desert and mines of western Utah. So the boys were able to, when the boys, the young little boys, at least Charlie was interviewed, he did corroborate that they went camping with his dad. So the police are going to search all these areas where they think she might be. We talked to the workers who were there. They are talking about how incredibly dangerous these mines are. They are all unstable. They're man-made and unkept. And they do not even want just regular search and rescue people in there, unless you have some kind of mine experience, because it is so dangerous. They just don't want people who are searching, trying to help, be lost and then have to find them. So this is just a vast, almost 5-hour drive stretch of desert that she could be in. They start to exhaust their ideas without any specific leads or clues from Josh or anyone involved. It is a vast area that's going to become very, very hard to even find anyone. So episode 8 is called Wearing a Wire. So Josh's oldest sister, Jennifer Graves, wants to wear a wire and approaches the police about this idea. And she's trying to get to Josh and ask what happened to Susan. This does not go well. It just ends up becoming a huge family blow up because the whole family that is on Steve's side of the Powell family is very protective of Josh, and they seem very hateful of Susan. Nothing about what they're doing seems right. In episode 9, The Light of Seattle, Josh's father, Steve, is put under the spotlight. So we really see the full spectrum of his creepy behavior, which later on we'll understand that because of Josh's father, Steve, being such a creeper. He actually was a 2-time convicted sex offender, and this will result in why the boys were taken from Josh's care. I'm not sure if I'll mention that when I get to it. We'll see. In episode 10, it's called Charlie. And this is about Susan's oldest son, Charlie. He starts kindergarten at 6, and he starts to open up without his dad's constant watch. So teachers are taking notice of the art he's drawing. They're taking notice of his behavior. They're saying he's not a bad kid, but Josh really let the kids just run wild unless they were going away. Unless they were with an adult, then he was right on them. So teachers really dislike him and the family, except for Jennifer, or even Lisa is his youngest sister. I'm not sure. I forgot, because she doesn't really play a big part, but this is all about Charlie now. So, cause Charlie was interviewed briefly, a few times. He might have been the key to possibly answering something, because it sounds like he may have been there and has even mentioned that they went camping and mommy was in the trunk. So the next episode is called Operation Tsunami. Police want to wiretap the Powell household. So Susan's family decide, and also to try and help the investigators with this, they organize what's called a honking wave in memory of Susan, and they decide to do it very near where Josh and his family can see. And this is to flesh out any information and put pressure on the Powells, also known as tickling the wire. Means they kind of do a little external things to put pressure or bother them so that when they hear it on the phone, maybe it will, you know, put some information out there. Next episode is Topaz Mountain. It's a shallow grave, leads nowhere. They did find a possible grave site. They were unable to determine. There was no bones in there. Josh's computer is analyzed and brings new leads and gets the kids seized. That's what I mentioned before. When they did a search warrant on the for the house and Josh's things, it's when they found Steve's creepy voyeuristic videos of him filming many, you know, young girls and women that he would see. And it's beyond creepy, but he ends up going to jail for it, and the kids are not allowed in the house, which is where Josh was living. So in order for Josh to get his kids back, he takes us to episode 13, which is called For the Kids. And Josh goes to court to get his sons back. They decide that he is only to have supervised visits. And he was even ordered by a judge to take a psychosexual exam to determine, you know, to determine whether he can get his kids back. At this point, Susan's parents are raising the boys, and they're trying to instill some structure that had been missing from their lives. You can imagine that after Susan died, Josh was not cleaning the house or cooking dinner or doing any of the work that she was doing in order to raise her boys to be, you know, strong young men. He was selfish, and he just got rid of his wife. And I think this whole thing is just so sad. So, but Josh's brother, Michael, sold his car weeks after Susan's disappearance, and our investigators are trying to track it down. They did have a cadaver dog sniff it, and I think they were able to say that there was a smell of decomp in the trunk. So episode 14, it's Killing Susan's Sons. So on January 19th, 2012, Josh locks out a frantic social worker on a supervised visit with his sons. So she was there to supervise the visit, but what happened is he told the boys, "Hey, I have presents." They all run in, and he slams the door in her face. She's calling 911, and it is the most frustrating 911 call, because she is just losing it. She says she smells gasoline in the house. She's very worried about what is to happen. Minutes later, the house is just explodes in flames, claiming all three lives inside. Charlie was 7 and Brayden was 5. The details of their death are horrid. There was a hatchet found by Josh's body, and there was hatchet wounds on the backs of their heads and necks, but that is not how they died. They were found holding hands and had died from smoke inhalation. So in episode 15, the fall of the House of Powell. After Josh's death, his younger brother Michael, quote, made a play for Josh and Susan's life insurance, and now investigators focus on him more. They were unable to find anything. He ended up jumping from a park top of a parking garage when things got a little too close. Episode 16 is called Chasing Leads. This is really just an prison informant and a stripper named Summer who supposedly knew Josh led police on a useless chase. And this episode is really good to show how different leads can lead nowhere and how an officer, when they're a good investigator, will search every single lead. It can waste a lot of time and resources. Episode 17 is called Cold Case. The West Valley City Police declare Susan Powell's case cold. Stephen Powell, a twice convicted sex offender, died alone from heart failure. This story, and as much as I hope that they release more and more, I think that the only conclusion would be to find Susan at this point, but they just call, this is just a completely cold case. You can see all the usual people of interest and suspects have all died and took the truth with them. Episode 18, it's called Angel of Hope. After 10 years of Susan's case being cold, her friends and family take solace in telling her story as a cautionary tale for people in abusive relationships. This was really important. It points out that people who don't... Susan wasn't being beaten. She didn't have bruises on her or a trail of police reports to document any type of abuse that was going on. Everything going on with her was very mental. He controlled all of the assets of her money. And because I feel that she was raised, you know, as a good Mormon girl, she felt that her duty in life was to be a good wife and mother. And in a lot of ways, she should have just been a good wife and mother to a nice Mormon boy, and they could have lived a really long, happy life. But unfortunately, she got roped into a con artist psychopath named Josh Powell, who controlled everything about her. There were certain things she wasn't allowed to do, like go on the computer, look on the internet. She couldn't have her own bank account. She actually had a secret bank account, but all the money was to go into their joint account, and it just never got to her. She never was able to spend any money on herself except for cheap things, and it's an abusive relationship. Just because people aren't being hurt or hit doesn't mean that she wasn't completely unable to get out from under his control. Now, there were a few bonus episodes. One of them was dumpster drops. And this is GPS on Josh's minivan show he made a lot of stops at dumpsters and a canal in Idaho. And investigators can only conclude that he was absolutely getting rid of forensic evidence in these dumpsters. And this was released only recently, because it was at very high secrecy amongst the police departments that there was a GPS tracker on his car. So then we go to the car crash con, and there were three people that Josh was involved, very questionable accidents. I mean, the accidents happened. Yes, people, all three of them hit his bumper because he did a like brake check to them. And then when they saw him, they said he was fine. He didn't seem to have any injuries at all. But of course, he still went to chiropractors and was doctors and got prescriptions for massage therapy and then shook down those people's insurance companies for the money on that. So he actually has a few of those and they're inspecting the possible insurance fraud. All right, I'm almost finishing up here, so... Project Sunlight shows new evidence from digital forensics. So, this is a little confusing. I'm going to try and explain it. The new evidence is Josh was ordered by a judge to take a psychosexual exam when his computer was seized during one of the warrants, search warrants, and they found some incestuous cartoon porn, bestiality porn, it was cartoon drawings and snippets, and that's why they a lot of people close to the case feel that that was the breaking point, because within a few days, that's when he killed himself and his sons, because they thought that was just the last tipping point for him. But what the investigators are finding is that this was not Josh's computer. Josh had a tricked out, awesome, self-built tower computer, which left Susan to get a secondhand computer that was a very, you know, had a very few functions, that she bought for $100, from somebody clearing out their business, which sent Josh into an uproar, but this was her computer. Now these, little, you know, bites of porn were put into like the reserve. So someone had already cleaned the computer out, but these were put in kind of in the back files. So I think what they're trying to say is if these were brought to light as being Susan's computer, but she bought it secondhand from someone else, and that person most likely actually put that porn on there, and it was not Josh's, which is the reason why they never arrested Josh for child pornography, and being like, you know, any sexual charges like that, because they couldn't prove that he was the one who looked at these photos. So Project Sunlight is interesting in that regard. I think it's a different idea or a take on it. I'm not sure that the boys would have been safer with him either way, just because of the mounting pressures put on him. And finally, Justice Lay, there were wiretaps from Project Tsunami that came to light. And the Powell family was, in fact, dangerous for Charlie and Braden. Okay, so that wraps up and concludes my deep dive on the podcast Cold. If you want to learn more about the Susan Cox Powell case, this is the pod. It goes into everything from the case files that are related to this. Dave Cawley did an amazing job trying to be as thorough as possible on this case. I would love one day for them to say that they found her. I would love more than anything. I just feel terrible for this story, for this tragedy that happened with her and her boys. This all could have been, I feel like this all could have been avoided, but in any case, maybe we can look at this as some kind of cautionary tale, like her friends want, to help other people who are in abusive relationships and to help them to get out, because everybody needs a support system. You can't just be closed off from everyone, and no man should really tell you what to do. I mean, if you're a grown woman, and she was extremely very capable and independent and could have had a handle on everything, but he just wouldn't let her. Ugh. So I'm going to conclude it. I'm done talking about it. I worked my butt off writing all these and listening to it again, and I'm exhausted. Let's move on. This segment we like to call the Weeklies. For all those weekly cases, you know. On Case File this week, they had done the case called the Strip Search Scam. So what happened is there's a local McDonald's got a phone call from someone claiming to be an officer, stating that one of their employees had stolen a purse or money from a customer, and they were looking into the investigation that day. So they had her go into the manager's office with this man on the phone, and he said to conduct a strip search. So they did. They took all her clothes. They took her underwear. They gave her nothing but an apron, as he then instructed her to run in place so as to, in case anything falls. She is 15 years old. She is terrified, and she is put into her manager's office, and her manager is a woman, states, you know, we're just trying to cooperate with the police, but the man on the phone says, get a male employee in there to watch her while you guys do your job. So she's like, okay, so she does, But very soon, the employees, the male employees, I think there's two of them that they try and get to stay with her while the, you know, the so-called police are going to be showing up. They are, you know, asked by the officer on the phone, you know, to look at her body and describe it. And they start to get incredibly uncomfortable, rightfully so. They run out of the office and say, "This is messed up. I just want to do my job. Something's not right." They don't catch on. The manager is still insistent that this must be some kind of theft and they need to cooperate with police. But because she doesn't have any more male employees to watch her, she decides to call her fiancé to stay with her while the, quote, officers are to show up. The man on the phone instructs this manager's fiancé to have her do star jumps off of the desk in case anything falls out, to have her run in place till she's sweaty, to in case, quote, anything falls out, to have her sit on his lap and give him a kiss because there might be alcohol on her breath or there might be drugs. There are a number of things that this man on the phone instructs the male fiancé to do that he carries out that I have to give you a trigger warning. It's all maybe excessively detailed. She spent 3 hours in that office before anyone realized that this person on the phone was a hoaxer and was not a police officer. The managers and the fiance were all criminally prosecuted for, you know, kidnapping, for, you know, conducting a search, the unlawful search and seizure. And they all spend time in jail. Now, meanwhile, the detectives are starting to put two and two together and find out that this hoaxer has been calling many, many fast food chains trying to do the same thing. And when they put it together, they found that there was a man who had been taking out calling cards. And basically, they were able to connect him to all of these hoaxes. It came down for him to go to trial, the hoaxer, he was acquitted. The victim who was assaulted in this instance then turned to sue McDonald's for not doing the proper training on their managers. And I believe she won her lawsuit. I think they're trying to... I guess, what's the word? Fight back on that? They're trying to open another suit, trying to reverse that decision. I'm not really sure, but to me, McDonald's has more than enough money to pay everyone so much more. The victim never went back to work at a McDonald's, of course, but she's currently had to put her life on hold after the whole assault. As you can imagine, it was absolutely horrific, and the whole thing was on video for the court and jury to see. This case had me so angry, I almost just decided to start recording after I heard it, but I was breathing fire. I was so upset. I can't believe I've never heard of this case before, but Case File absolutely knocked it out of the park yet again. Thank you so freaking much for informing me about the strip search scam so I can tell my daughter to never work for a fast food chain ever, ever, ever. Never work for a restaurant. Oh, God, the exploitation is just... makes me so mad. This week on the Fall Line, it was parts, 2 and 3, The Victims of Samuel Little. So if anyone out there is a serial killer nut, I'm sure you probably have heard of Samuel Little. He's currently the most prolific convicted serial killer. He claims to have killed 93 women. The FBI has confirmed 50. That's more than the Green River Killer. That's definitely more than Gacy. And that's more than Ted Bundy. And it's even more than Jeffrey Dahmer. This man definitely killed 50 people, and he's claiming 93. So, he's happened across 19 states. He has a very transient lifestyle. He would just hop around from state to state. And if any woman that he was with, he tried to find prostitutes and drug addicts because he felt that they would not be missed. Now, he had also claimed that if they touched their neck, he pretty much said to himself, that was their sign to me that I was going to take them. Meaning, I'm going to kill them because they touched their neck and somehow that's a sign. The man is a sexual sadist. It's disgusting. He's really a despisable man. Now, he has gone largely, this spanned his 30-year killing spree, I guess, is a ton of black women who currently are missing. And a lot of their death certificates do not say homicide. They say things like undetermined or natural causes, because they would say natural causes, if they felt law enforcement, if they felt that this woman died from a drug overdose, it was considered a natural cause death. So you have to imagine that none of those women's death certificates are going to show as being related to a possible homicide or missing person, because if their bodies were found and they were considered undetermined death or natural causes, it doesn't come up easily on any kind of search through NamUs, which is the database that the police go through when they try and find missing people. So Samuel Little fancies himself as an artist. I saw his art. I'm a better artist, I'll be honest. But he has some talents in that regard. So he has been drawing his victims. And we're hoping that through the release of these drawings, that someone will be able to recognize the people that he's disappeared. And hopefully we can find their families, we can give them names, and we can put a close on this psychopath's crimes. So I strongly advise if anybody wishes to look at the Samuel Little drawings. There are still many women who have been disposed of like garbage by this absolute monster who deserve to have their names back. So if you like, go ahead and check those out. So if you know something, maybe you can make a phone call and bring some peace. If not, just, you know, education is the best way. We can't ignore the people who live on the fringes of our society and pretend that their lives didn't matter, because this man certainly thought that their lives didn't matter, but he was very wrong. There are a lot of family out there, and they were interviewed on this podcast, and they hopefully will get the justice that they need. This week on Generation Y, they had done the case of Kendrick Johnson. Now, I thought that this was pretty familiar, but I didn't understand that they had decided to redo another look into this case. They did actually do a Kendrick Johnson episode before that I had listened to, so I was a little confused, like, wait, didn't they do this already? I wasn't sure, but I decided, okay, I'm familiar with this case, let's give it another listen. So this is the mysterious death of a 17-year-old black athlete when they found him rolled up in a gym mat. Now, the first autopsy ruled that he had a death of situational asphyxiation. What they were trying to put together is that Kendrick had put his basketball shoes on top of these mats in the smaller gym area. And what he would do is he and a friend would kind of share the same pair of shoes. They weren't rich, and they would kind of hide it on these gym mats and then pick them up later because they had to pay for lockers or whatever reason. They were sharing gym shoes. They believe that what happened is that Kendrick had somehow shimmied himself into this gym mat, got stuck, no one was there to hear him, and he eventually suffocated and died. Now, his family believe that this is a bunch of garbage. They just cannot imagine that their son would go into what looks like an incredibly small hole. It just seems so, like, how would he put himself there? So they did get a second autopsy, which the second autopsy found that he did have a blunt force trauma to his neck. Now, the third autopsy actually backed up what the second autopsy said, but was able to state that it was that trauma was from a weight or a dumbbell, and I'm not sure how they were able to figure that out. But more and more, the Johnsons were, you know, desperately trying to get justice in any way that they could after their son was death was ruled an accident. They just don't believe it. But unfortunately, they were sued for defamation against the Bell brothers. I think it was, I don't remember their first names. They were the Bell brothers. And their father actually is an FBI agent. And it is strange that the cameras that are supposed to show perhaps what happened to Kendrick weren't working that day. So nothing about this, about his death, really adds up. It could be an accident, a very tragic accident, but it also looks it looks very, very suspicious. So if you want to look at the suspicious, weird, strange details of Kendrick Johnson's death, Generation Y is the place to go for that. They just do the facts, ma'am. They are not messing around with their thoughts or feelings about it. It is very well researched. Thank you so much, Generation Y. On Crime Junkie this week, they did the case of Tara Calico. Tara Calico was a young, bright student who had her life pretty well situated. And she went on her bike ride one day. She went on a long 17-mile bike ride that went up and down up the side of the freeway by her house. Her mom was not a fan of this, but she knew her daughter was older. There really wasn't anything she could do. She was athletic. She had an appointment right after at noon. So she told her mom, if I'm not back from my bike ride, find me, you know, so I don't lose track of time. She's an extremely prompt young lady, but she never got home. She disappeared while on her bike ride, and her mom went up and down the freeway, never to find her or her bicycle. Now, many years later in Florida, there was a gold van that pulled out of a parking lot. And when a woman looked back at that spot, there was a Polaroid photo there of a young woman with duct tape over her mouth. Her hands looks like she's bound. And next to her, by some pillows, is a young boy, not much older than 9, I would say, younger than 9 years old, also with his mouth duct tape and looking like his hands are tied behind his back. Neither of these kids look well, but somehow they are roped into the Tara Calico case because the photo looks very similar to Tara. So much so that one of the friends of the family brought it up. Now, the FBI has not been able to find who these kids are. Obviously, they look like they're in distress. It's not a good situation. I looked up this photo. In it absolutely is terrifying. I hate it. I hate it a lot. And the FBI has never really solved that side of the case. Tara Calico has not been found. However, there have been confessions that some of her, boyfriend's friends saw her, accidentally hit her, threw her in the car, and then decided to bury her and get rid of the bike. I don't know that they followed that up. I don't think anyone knows what happened to Tara Calico. It's just a mystery, and if it's on your radar, maybe there's something you can do about it. But until then, you won't know until you check out Crime Junkie and look at Tara Calico's case. And perhaps, maybe, there can be something that can be put together. I hope one day she's found. This week, I decided to check out a podcast I have not yet. And I heard it was really good, but it's simply called Criminal. It's got a white background. The last time I've looked at it, they would have like part one and part two, and I didn't want to start off my experience with Criminal on like a two part or anything. So they put out an interview with filmmaker Errol Morris. He did a movie called, one of his more famous movies is called The Thin Blue Line. It helped to exonerate a man who was wrongfully convicted. All he had to do was track down a few witnesses, and I guess someone knew something. But he was interviewed because he had this idea for a movie he really wanted to do about an insurance agent who was inspecting or investigating the city of Vernon, Florida. The reason is because this place in Vernon, Florida is also called Nub City because they do self-mutilation to get their life insurance policies. And how this works is that they would cut off a hand or an arm or a leg, preferably your left arm and right leg, so you can still use crutches. Now, he wanted to go down to Vernon, Florida and interview these people, but that agent told him, don't do it. If these people are willing to cut off their own limbs, what do you think they'll do to you? So he said he had spent some time there. He really did want to try and check out what is going on with this fraud going in town, but nobody would talk to him. And in fact, he said he felt he's had his life threatened multiple times. So this is a movie that he really wants to do. It is absolutely a fascinating idea. Errol Morris seems like a very interesting man. In fact, he even did a little name drop with his interview of Ed Gein, who was at the Wisconsin Institute for the Criminally Insane, and said he was just a very soft-spoken guy, and I believe it. He was convicted, Ed Gein, you know, he was convicted of really two murders, but he was just so batshit. They were just like, okay, poor crazy person, we're gonna have to put you away for a while. And they did. They put him away till he died. And he was considered like a model inmate, if you were a model patient. But, so that was the interview with Errol Morris on Criminal. So I'll check Criminal out again. It was really well done. And that was just a little interview that I got to take part in. And that was super interesting, that insurance fraud stuff. Ooh, shivers. These are my absolute favorite podcasts. Ooh. This week on my absolute favorites, we got Voices for Justice. This episode is called Remembering Alyssa, and Sarah, our host, invites Alyssa's friends to a Zoom meeting to remember her sister. That was absolutely beautiful, and you really do get a sense of who Alyssa was as a person through the stories of her friends. So that was a beautiful, awesome memorial to a missing woman, Alyssa Turney. So check out Voices for Justice. It was beautiful. Wine and Crime this week came out with Elvis Crimes. We talked a lot about Elvis Presley and his early life, and to be honest, these are a lot of Elvis Presley impersonators doing dirty, killing people, burglarizing for whatever reason. It seems that Elvis impersonators are kind of criminal or shady. At least for their stories, they had some good ones. And this week on TCO, which is True Crime Obsessed, Who Killed Chandra Levy? She's a DC intern who was found dead in the woods 1 year after her disappearance. A senator was somehow involved because she was, I guess, seeing him on the sly. So we still don't know who killed Chandra Levy. On another podcast that they do, which is called Obsessed with Disappeared, they are doing the ID episode, The Disappearance of Christy Cornwell. So Christy Cornwell is taking a late walk and is talking on the phone with her boyfriend when her boyfriend hears her being abducted. And that is the story. We're like, what happened to Christy Cornwell? And finally, I'm going to go about the Morbid Girls on Morbid this week. We went into Bible John. He is known as the UK Zodiac. He killed three women he picked up from the Barrowland Ballroom. He has never been apprehended, and some believe that Peter Tobin is Bible John. And if you know, Peter Tobin is a convicted serial killer in the UK. He's an absolute monster and was around in this area at the time. There are reasons to believe he might be Peter Tobin, and there's also reason to believe that Bible John is someone else. So that was very interesting. Listen to that, and maybe you can come up with your own conclusions. And finally, Ash and Elena from Morbid are doing their Crime Countdown, which is a Parcast network show. This week, they did Infamous Alcatraz Inmates, which, if you can even think of who is an Alcatraz, they covered it, and then some. So that was a very interesting episode, and that is going to conclude my absolute favorites for this week. If you would like to, you can find me on Instagram at Grace's World of True Crime Podcast. You could find me on Facebook, same thing, Grace's World of True Crime Podcast, and my Twitter account, Grace's World of True Crime Podcast. And if you'd like, you can also go to the Anchor app. You can click on my Anchor link and you can support me if you so wish, just by clicking that little support button and throwing me a dime or two. I do everything by myself here in this podcast. I write it, research it, edit it, record it, vocals, music, you name it. This is really my passion project. So if you want to throw a little love my way, please do. Otherwise, I cannot wait to see you guys next week, and stay sane out there and have a lovely life. See you next week. And I just felt like playing you guys out. A little something nice, you know. Good luck, everybody. Don't be an irony. We love you. Bye. Next time. Goodbye. See ya.